Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Steve Cobble of the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses his hopes for moving the progressive agenda forward under the presidency of Barack Obama. Marty Rouse, National Field Director of the Human Rights Campaign, who assesses the battle lines set up after the recent passage of California's Proposition 8 ban on gay marriage. And BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who examines the millions of uncounted votes across the nation and tens of thousands in Georgia, where a U.S. Senate seat hangs in the balance. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The fallout from the American-driven global financial crisis has led to the first leadership summit of the G20, a group of industrialized and developing nations meeting in Washington, D.C. on November 15th. To lay the groundwork for the summit, French President Nicolas Sarkozy, the current president of the European Union, has called for a new Bretton Woods agreement to reform the global financial system. Sarkozy is also pushing for a common regulatory framework between the EU, England, and the United States. EU finance ministers have voted for tighter supervision and regulation of banks and financial institutions. But International Monetary Fund Managing Director Dominique Strauss-Kahn is downplaying expectations for the G20 summit. The IMF chief expects the gathering of world leaders to analyze the current crisis and to set up working groups to negotiate a future treaty. Kahn insisted a change in the voting formula for the IMF and the World Bank, which is controlled by the U.S. and the EU, would not be a subject for debate. Yet the summit could provide an important opportunity for emerging nations like Brazil, China, India, and South Africa to shape the new global economic order that has been dominated by wealthy countries. The developing world is pushing for more influence and a greater share of the votes on the boards of the IMF and the World Bank. Colombia's top military commander, General Mario Montoya, has resigned in the aftermath of a scandal involving the killing of civilians who were falsely counted as leftist guerrillas. Over the summer, Montoya was celebrated as a hero for the rescue of hostages, including former presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt and three U.S. military contractors held by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. But Montoya has relationships with right-wing paramilitary groups and is linked to the disappearance of civilians. Montoya was embarrassed in late October when Colombian President Álvaro Uribe fired 27 army officers, including three generals, after an investigation into the murder of 11 civilians by soldiers. President Uribe faces pressure from the U.S. Congress to crack down on human rights abuses by the military. Colombia currently receives $5.5 billion a year in aid from the United States, and Democrats have held up consideration of the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Pact over human rights concerns. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy praised Montoya's resignation, telling The Washington Post, "He shared responsibility for widespread and systematic abuses by the Colombian military. For years, our concern about these crimes and General Montoya's role have been ignored." Environmental and Native American activists in Arizona are pledging to continue their legal battle over a development plan to make snow from reclaimed wastewater in the San Francisco mountains. The plaintiffs say the ski resort plan, in a mountain range considered sacred by 13 tribes, violates the 1993 Religious Freedom Protection Act and the 1969 National Environmental Policy Act. In March 2007, a three-judge appeals panel ruled in favor of the eco-activists on two counts. But in August, an 11-judge panel overturned that decision and dismissed the lawsuit, saying the snow made of reclaimed wastewater was not a substantial burden to the practice of Native religions. The plaintiffs are planning an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorney Howard Shanker, representing the tribes and environmentalists, told the news magazine In These Times, "The court is placing itself in the position of judging the legitimacy of Native American beliefs, which is not the proper role for the courts." Eco-activists also complain the federal appeals court ignored the potential for health problems from traces of hazardous chemicals in the wastewater. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Throughout the presidential campaign, Republican candidate John McCain attacked his Democratic opponent Barack Obama as a mysterious radical socialist who associated with known terrorists. But now that the campaign is over and the GOP's vicious attack machine has taken a brief hiatus, President-elect Obama is preparing to confront the nation's major financial crises and two ongoing wars when he enters the White House in January. Americans are now waiting to find out what policies the new president will pursue and the team he'll select to execute his program. Many of those individuals mentioned for cabinet posts for the incoming Obama administration are familiar names from the presidency of Bill Clinton. While officials of the Clinton White House would bring valuable experience to a new administration, their selection would disappoint many progressives who are hoping that Obama will make good on his pledge for shaking up business as usual in Washington. Barack Obama's first major announced appointment, Rahm Emanuel, as chief of staff, was troubling to many progressives. Emanuel, a senior advisor to Clinton from 1993 to 1998, helped pass NAFTA and welfare reform. Elected as an Illinois representative in 2002, he was a supporter of President Bush's war in Iraq and well known as a hawkish ally of Israel. Later, as chair of the 2006 Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Emanuel opposed the candidacies of many anti-war Democrats. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Cobble, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-founder of Progressive Democrats of America, who worked on Dennis Kucinich's 2004 and 2008 presidential campaigns. He assesses the election results and discusses his hopes for moving the progressive agenda forward under the presidency of Barack Obama.
Your listeners may not be completely aware of actually what a large victory this was, because, of course, they're now trying to convince us that we still live in a center-right country rather than, at the moment at least, a center-left country. And Barack Obama just got 53% of the vote, which means that's the third highest of any Democrat who's been elected president. Franklin Roosevelt got more than that a couple times, about three times, and Lyndon Johnson did. But Bill Clinton didn't, Harry Truman didn't, Jimmy Carter didn't, Al Gore didn't, even though he actually did win. And we know that the electoral landscape was transformed, the Electoral College landscape, that was a smashing victory that he won there. And in the House and Senate, the Democrats have not won back-to-back victories of the size that they did in 2006 and 2008 since Franklin Roosevelt's 1932 election. So this is actually literally a once-in-a-lifetime election for center-left folks. And, you know, people should keep that in mind when they're not happy just because we're getting rid of Bush or because Barack Obama is undeniably smart and has quite the presence and cool, but this was a big deal, potentially.
Steve Cobble, as you look at the many intractable problems that this nation and the world now faces and the very hard task that Barack Obama's administration have ahead of them, what is the progressive movement's agenda here, and how neatly does it fit in with the priorities of the Obama administration? And I realize it may be a little bit too early to figure out where things lie, but what's your sense of it?
Well, my sense of it is that Barack Obama is actually a wordsmith and a bit of a prose poet. And the reason I bring that up is he takes the words he uses quite seriously. So I actually think we'd be smart to start by figuring out what it is that he said he was going to do. And if we're happy with that, we should try to hold him to it. And if we're not happy with that, we should take that as a starting point and then push further, as, you know, the labor movement did with Franklin Roosevelt, for instance. So he has said he wants to make a big impact on climate change and put, you know, $15 billion a year for at least the next 10 years into alternative energy economy and green jobs. And I would say that's a good minimum down payment. And we should fight for at least that. He's called for health care for everybody, and he has made it clear that he has resisted calling for single-payer health care, which many of your listeners would support. I think there are things that he could do on health care that would be complementary, would not foreclose the option of single-payer health care, whether or not we can get the Congress to do that now. I mean, as a for instance, I don't know what would stop anybody from just putting kids on their own form of Medicare, the minimum we need to do in foreign policy is help him get out of Iraq, as he's promised. The fact that Obama wants to take some of the troops out of Iraq and put them in Afghanistan, but the minimum progressives want to do is at least hold him to the promise to get out of Iraq.
Steve, just a final question here. As we all expect, the Republicans, punditocracy in Washington, and the forces of moderation are going to try and trim Barack Obama's sails when he takes the presidency and try and really kind of scale back whatever grand scheme he might have in terms of policy change. How do you think the progressive movement can organize itself to be an effective counterweight to what we know is coming in terms of the attacks, personal and policy attacks, that are going to come from the right?
Well, I would say first we should do our homework and find out what it is that he promised, because that's what he ran on. And also, he's written two books, so he, a lot of his stuff is what he believes is already in print or on video. When we demand that he do things, we just need to be respectful about it. Because for whatever reason, he read the zeitgeist better than we did on some level. He figured out how to be the first African-American elected president. No trivial thing. And there are things where he might disagree with us, where we can have a conversation, and he's proven that he's a pretty good listener. So I would say we should come at him in that spirit. We should come to him and say, here's how we think this would be the best thing, and look, we've organized these, thousands and millions of people that agree with us, and they would really like you to do this, and oh, by the way, you said in Iowa that you wanted to do this. And oh, by the way, the labor movement made Franklin Roosevelt not just a better president by taking him further than he wanted to go. They made Roosevelt do things that were incredibly popular. And I think Barack Obama's in the same situation. He told us many times, I want you to push me. I need you to keep being organized after we win. And, of course, he said that during the campaign, and it was partly because he knew that it made us feel good that, he was going to listen to us after he won. But I don't forget the fact that he was an organizer, and I have the feeling he knows that to take on entrenched power, he's going to need the help of millions of people. So that's a hopeful sign, and we should push him on that until he proves he didn't really mean it. And I think he did mean it. We'll see.
That was Steve Covell, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Visit the group's website at ips-dc.org or call area code 202-234-9382. Of the many ballot initiatives this year in California, the one that attracted the most attention and tens of millions of dollars in funding on both sides was Proposition 8, a constitutional amendment that defined marriage as between a man and a woman. The state Supreme Court, in a May 16th 4-3 ruling, struck down the state's ban on same-sex marriage, approved by voters in 2000, affirming that California's constitution protects a fundamental right to marry that extends equally to same-sex couples. But the passage of Proposition 8 by a nearly 53% margin on November 4th could end the short-lived legal right of gays and lesbians in America's most populous state to marry. Voters in Arizona and Florida also passed amendments to their state's constitutions outlawing gay marriage. In reaction to the passage of the gay marriage ban in California, thousands of people took to the streets across the state, some targeting Mormon and other conservative churches, which had raised millions to promote the amendment. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marty Rouse, National Field Director for the Human Rights Campaign, which works for equal rights for gays and lesbians. He discusses the forces on both sides of the ballot question, whether gay marriages that have already taken place in California will remain legally valid, and next steps for those working to overturn the marriage ban.
We are pleased that there's been a dramatic shift in the recognition of gay and lesbian couples from the population in California from the last time they had a ballot question 8 years ago. We lost then by just over 20 points. On Tuesday, we lost by 2.5 to 3 points. So there's been a significant shift in support of gay and lesbian couples and the recognition that they deserve to be treated equally. Unfortunately, of course, we did not break the 50% threshold, so in some ways it was a devastating loss.
After Prop 8 passed, many opponents protested vociferously the massive financial contributions from the Church of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormons, which is claiming the institution and its individual members contributed about $14 million for the Vote Yes campaign. And I know the Knights of Columbus, which is the largest Catholic fraternal order in the U.S., also contributed $1 million. There's no problem with tax-exempt organizations like religious groups spending money on these propositions?
Well, tax-exempt 501c3 organizations are legally able to participate in ballot initiative questions. They cannot contribute to electoral candidates, but for ballot questions, they absolutely are within their legal means to contribute as long as it doesn't reach a certain threshold of their total annual budget.
Speaking of tax-exempt organizations then, Marty Rouse, how did the Human Rights Campaign participate in this effort?
Well, early on, what we tried to do is we worked in coalition with other groups to actually try to stop the ballot question from appearing on the ballot in the first place. There was a decline to sign campaign that HRC participated in with bodies and with money. We contributed $100,000, and I think it was 8 staff people on the ground to actually stand in front of shopping centers, usually Walmarts and other places like that, to try to get the residents of California not to sign these petitions to put this on the ballot. We were ultimately unsuccessful. I think we came pretty close, but we worked in coalition with others. After it was officially going to be on the ballot, then HRC did join the leadership team of the organization, the coalition, which is called Equality for All, and then the No on 8 campaign, and we raised and contributed over $3 million in cash to the No on 8 campaign, as well as several staff members spent many months on the campaign trail.
I understand that California Attorney General Jerry Brown has said that gay marriages that took place before this proposition passed would be legal, would still be valid. Is that your understanding? And how many couples are we talking about?
At last count, I believe it was just over 18,000 gay and lesbian couples have been legally married in the state of California. And my understanding is that the common perception and common understanding is that indeed those marriages will be valid. However, I can imagine that there will be some challenge to those marriages from some groups, so it remains to be seen.
What's your next step in trying to make gay marriage legal in California?
Well, there is going to be a legal challenge. There are several legal challenges filed already, and we'll see what the state Supreme Court ultimately decides to do about those challenges. But regardless, there needs to be continued education throughout the state of California among all the populations. The younger you are, the more supportive you are of marriage equality. This is clearly an issue where the more people understand and know people that are gay or lesbian and understand their relationships, the more supportive they are of them. So we need everybody to live their lives more openly. In the short term, that's what we need to do. This might be on the ballot in 2 years again or in 4 years, but it's definitely going to be back on the ballot more than likely very soon, and we feel that we will be ultimately successful. And in the meantime, we have other states that we know are going to be going forward with marriage equality. There seems to be a race between Vermont, New Jersey, and New York for which state can pass and enact marriage legislation most quickly. So we expect that those three states will likely have marriage equality in their states soon.
That was Marty Rouse of the Human Rights Campaign. For more information, visit the group's website at hrc.org or call their Washington, D.C. office at 202-628-4160. With bitter memories and suspicion surrounding the integrity of the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections, activist groups and attorneys working with the Democratic Party watched closely as ballots were counted in this year's national election. While Barack Obama convincingly won across the nation, a week after votes were cast, many election protection monitors were looking closely at unresolved Senate races in Minnesota, Alaska, and Georgia. Democrats are hoping to have 60 Senate votes to prevent Republicans from using filibusters to block legislation in the next Congress. A recount is now underway in Minnesota in the race between GOP Senator Norm Coleman and his comedian challenger, Democrat Al Franken, with just 206 votes separating the two. In Alaska, Republican Senator Ted Stevens, recently convicted of felony charges, led Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich, a Democrat, by 3,257 votes, but another 90,000 votes must still be counted. In Georgia, GOP Senator Saxby Chambliss, who failed to win 50% of the votes in his race with Democrat Jim Martin, is preparing for a runoff election on December 2nd. BBC TV investigative journalist Greg Palast has been watching the election returns in Georgia and reports that over 50,000 new voters in that state were blocked from having their ballots counted, resulting from provisions of the federal Help America Vote Act passed in 2002. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Palast, who first reported the illegal purging of voters in Florida prior to the controversial 2000 election, about why tens of thousands of ballots in Georgia and millions more across the country were not counted in this election.
Democrats absolutely roll over the Republican Party and elect a African-American to the general delight of the entire planet. That was one part of history, which will never be forgotten. The other part has already been forgotten, in that it was probably the dirtiest election we've seen in more than a generation since the Jim Crow era, with more, believe it or not, with more African Americans and Hispanic voters disenfranchised more than ever. We were able to calculate quite exactly from official records that over 3 million votes were cast and not counted in the last election. We said it could be 6 million voters this time. We are probably low. It is unbelievable, Scott. Let me give you a couple numbers. Here's the official numbers so far. Officially, only 125 million people have voted versus 122 million in 2004. Are you really telling me that the number of people that turned out to vote this time is only 2% higher than 2004? So we went from a kind of half-baked election with no youth interest and, you know, very few swing states in play, to a massive, highly contested, multi-state operation, massive registration, and there's only a 2% increase in vote? No, I don't think so.
So where do these votes go?
Where do they go? Since George Bush came to office, since the Florida debacle, they passed something called, and George Bush signed, the Help America Vote Act, which, you know, George Bush is helping us vote, so you can well imagine. One of the things that did is that it created new powers for secretaries of state to basically do what Katherine Harris did, take the Florida system and spread it around the country. That is, it gave the power of secretaries of state to do two things. One, purge the voter rolls. That they've done with massive, massive attack, 2.7 million voters purged that were already on the rolls. In fact, one of the worst places, of course, is Georgia, where there's now a runoff for Senate. The Democrats would have swept that if people were allowed to vote. The second thing is called verification. Verification says that new voters, for the first time, must have their identity checked by the state. The Social Security computers have rejected 45% of the names submitted to them. Does that mean that 45% of the people attempting to register to vote are fraudulent? Forget it. People showed up and were not allowed to vote. Now, they were allowed to vote. A lot of people thought they voted because they were handed something called a provisional ballot. In the last election, there were 3 million provisional ballots handed out. If your name's missing from the voter rolls, you get a provisional ballot. But 1 million were not counted. 1 million. This time, it looks like about 6 million people were handed provisional ballots, and probably 2, 3, or 4 million were literally not counted. And that has meant four Democratic races across the nation. Runoff in Georgia, the Democrats could lose Alaska by a couple votes where provisional ballots are just run rampant. Minnesota, where it's dead close, a fairly clean state, but there's only 250-vote margin difference. So in other words, this could well prevent Barack Obama not from taking the presidency, but from governing by taking away a filibuster-proof Senate.
Greg Pallas, tell us a little bit about focusing on the Georgia race between Senator Saxby Chambliss and his Democratic opponent, Jim Martin. It seems like there was a lot of questions raised about missing ballots there in particular, as you raised the alarm generally across those battleground states and those battleground Senate races. Focus in a little bit on Georgia. What do we know about it?
It was the worst case in the country. I've always warned about Georgia. And part, I hate to say it, and here's the weird one, is that the Democrats have often been complicit in disenfranchising black voters. And the way that they do it, because the white Democratic Party of Georgia has always been very nervous of having a black majority party. Last time Senator Saxby Chambliss ran, he barely squeaked through by calling Max Cleland, who is the Democratic incumbent senator, a friend, literally a friend of Osama bin Laden. Now, Cleland was the guy who lost three limbs in Vietnam. So this time, the Obama forces registered over 500,000 new voters. Now, the polls are showing that the new voters were going 69 to 20% for Obama. I mean, all about 3.5 to 1. So if you take 500,000 new voters, and they go 3.5 to 1 for the Democrats, and they weren't just voting Obama and then switching over and voting for basically some, you know, let's put it straight, you know, some racist cracker. And yet, somehow, Martin is a couple points behind Chambliss. So, in other words, they were blocking new voters. We know officially, 50,000 new voters were blocked through this verification process. There will be a runoff in Georgia, but I don't know if those people who were not verified will have the right to vote in the runoff. It's unlikely.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Pallast. Read his articles online at gregpallast.com. Download a free copy of his illustrated pamphlet, Steal Back Your Vote, co-authored by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., at stealbackyourvote.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.